Welcome to the Recovery Stories Podcast, bringing you stories of hope, healing, and triumph over the bondage of addictions, mental health struggles, trauma, and dysfunctional family systems. Our courageous storytellers have chosen to live their journey out loud in order to show others that they don't have to suffer in silence. The stories you will hear are raw, real, and may involve graphic and triggering content. This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted Alumni Community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or are ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
Welcome to this episode of Rooted Recovery Stories. I am so excited to be here again with you today. My name is Patrick Custer. I'm your host, and we have got such a special guest that I'm so excited to introduce to you. Nationally and internationally renowned interventionist, author, speaker, and respected authority on complex mental health issues and the full spectrum of addictive disorders. She's also been featured on most major TV networks and serves as an on-air expert and consultant for CNN and Dr. Oz. And last, but certainly not least, she's a featured interventionist on past seasons of A&E's high-profile show, Intervention. Welcome, Heather Hayes.
Thank you. It's so exciting and such an honor to be here. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I mentioned to you before, I was so excited about this. I've been in the field a lot less time than you have, but I've been in it for a while and never actually got to meet with you and have a conversation. And so this is kind of a treat for me, the first time really on this format, having this intimate of a conversation with you and getting to kind of talk about your life.
Thank you. No, I know it's interesting because your name is so familiar and I've seen your podcast before. So it's really, I'm glad that we're meeting, and it's unusual that we're meeting this way for the first time, but I'm excited. So I'm really happy to be here.
Me too. And thank you again for giving us your time. I know this is just going to be such an awesome conversation. So let's just dive right in. I think the first thing I wanted to ask you is, especially with everything that's gone on lately, meaning the pandemic and how we've all had to pivot and everything, what is it about what you do professionally that gets you the most fired up right now?
God, such an interesting question, because I feel like I've been fired up about my profession since I started, which is really a blessing. I came into the field really kind of backwards, so it's impossible to talk about my profession and not include my personal journey, because it really started with my own personal journey. So my recovery story is that of an addicted adolescent young adult. And so I tried a lot of different things to reel it in. Truly, I could have been diagnosed effectively, efficiently, appropriately at 16 years old. And so I went through, again, the story of a teenager. I was kicked out of prep schools. I wrecked cars. I had terrible relationships with my family. And I went off to University of Georgia, and then I decided, I know how I can reel it in and quit embarrassing myself. I'm going to become a psych major. If I can only
see
psychology, then I'll know exactly how to fix everything and maybe even manipulate people better. I mean, I have to be honest, that was kind of in there too. So I went in my first psych class, psych 101. I remember the professor put this big thing up on, when we got to alcoholism, this big questionnaire up on the board. And it was like, do you ever drink more than you intended to? Yes. Do you ever do things you're embarrassed of the next day? Yes. Do you ever not remember what happened? Who doesn't? So I got all the way to the bottom, and I'd said yes to 18 out of 24. And at the bottom, it says, if you've said yes to three of these, you might have a problem. If you've said yes to four or more, you definitely have a problem. And so instead of saying, wow, I have a problem, I said, if I'd known that was at the bottom, I would have answered the questions differently. So it took me a while to eventually at 21, I ended up in treatment. And so at that point in time, when I got in there, it took a little while for my brain to clear and for me to really see that I had an illness that because believe me, if you think you can't control your life and you want to go study psychology to fix it, it's not a good way to go. Suddenly I had every diagnosis in the book, you know. So I was kind of relieved to hear that I had an illness. It was treatable. And at that point, I knew more than anything that I wanted to study psychology, continue down that path, become a therapist, and particularly work with young adults and adolescents at that time. I mean, I was young too. The grown-ups scared me. I could relate so much. You know, I then over time learned how important it was to.
You know, I think it's interesting that you, when you were talking about how you said yes to all of those things, you had the insight at that time to admit to yourself, yes, that's happening to me. Yes, that's happening. Because for so many of us, I think that we would have, didn't matter what was at the bottom of the thing, right? Like we would not say the truthful answer even to ourselves.
Well, I'm pretty sure that that very day I went out with my friends and started drinking white Russians and snorting cocaine and said, guess what? Of course I do this. I'm an alcoholic. You know, so I kind of, you know, this is what we do. So in a way I almost used it to feel my, you know, here's why I need to use. So yes. It was
that makes sense.
Honestly dishonest with myself. So, yes. Yeah. But to answer your question, you know, today, one of the things that I really feel so blessed about is that I've had the opportunity, because I got into recovery at 21, you know, I just celebrated 40 years in February. So
yeah. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. So I've had the opportunity to not only grow up, you know, developmentally, because I mean, I was 21, but I was really like 11. So developmentally grow up with the fortune of having a program of recovery to help lead me and support my own personal therapy, which I was in before I went into treatment and have continued throughout, as well as professionally, you know, learning and becoming a therapist. So in some ways, here I sit, really, it's so ingrained in my soul that, you know, I've been doing it for so long that I've always loved it. It's been a blessing. And I've had this toolbox full of tools that I've been gifted from above. You know, it's sort of like I realized that this is the only illness where we can have it and then have the ability to be better off from having had it. You know, other illnesses like diabetes, you want to get back to sort of like that baseline. But right. With substance use disorder, we can have an even better life. We can have tools and friends and opportunities that are beyond our wildest dream, or that, you know, as we call the promises, can come true for us. So
isn't that true?
It is. So today, you know, I'm able to kind of also look and say, all right, where am I at in my career? I've been doing this for almost 40 years. I've studied a lot. I've had amazing mentors. I've had great trainings. And what do I see as we've all evolved as a field of psychology, as a field of substance use disorder and mental health treatment? How do we best help those compassionately by taking out the stigma, you know, respectfully? How do we help those who are struggling with mental health and addiction? How do we help support their families? Like, you know, in a place where I've seen some things that have worked and seen some things that haven't, or that we've done wrong, or that we didn't know any better at the time, but now we're so much better at like considering trauma. And so that excites me, you know, excites me. I get so excited about the fact that we have collegiate recovery campuses around the country where young adults have done, you know, so incredibly well. They've gotten clean, they've gotten sober at a young age. And then they said, get out of our way, guys. We got this. We're going to go set up our own support on college campuses. And I often think, you know, I had like a little twinge of jealousy when they started. I was like, you know, I was in college. I was the only one I knew. And I thought, wow, like how great would that have been? You know, really incredible. So there's a lot of what's happening that's right that excites me. There's a lot of, you know, seeing years of us all working for the better that excites me. You know, there are things that pain me. You know, it pains me to see that the drugs are now contaminated and the people that aren't even that are using for the first and second time are dying of overdoses. You know, it pains me to see some of the ethical dilemmas going on out there. It pains me to see vulnerable families and their loved ones taken advantage of. But in the bigger picture, you know, there's a lot that we're doing right. And I feel like we often don't focus on that. There's a lot, the media comes in and talks a lot about, you know, what's not happening, who's not getting services, which is true. You know, 11% of the 23.5 million get services, which leaves that 89% that don't. We can do better. But also looking at, you know, what are we doing? What have we learned along the road? How can we come in and help people and make a difference?
Absolutely. So what would you say are the biggest obstacles that we're facing right now that are the most pressing as professionals and as both as professional from the professional side? And then for those of us who are in recovery or just in the general community, how can, what would you say we can do to come together to combat stigma, the current issues at hand?
Right. That's a great question. So, and I think there's so many different angles, so my mind is filled with different things that I want to say. So let me see if I can take it in small pieces.
Sure. Yeah.
Let's start with stigma. You know, I think we've done a lot to help work on stigma. I mean, we have done things like, I mean, I personally have scaled down the side of a building for, you know, to support addiction. More of us are talking about our personal stories on TV or out to the general public. We're working on educating. But I do think we can continue to educate. Those of us in recovery can speak out and talk about the success stories. We can ask the media. We can ask TV to also show the hope and not just the tragedy. But I think we also need to come together and help. You know, what I think we can do a better job of is really educating at a grassroots level our communities and our families about how to talk about addiction and mental health issues. I mean, can you imagine if we lived in a world where those conversations happened at the dinner table and our children knew that if this happened to you or if it happened to one of your loved ones or to one of your friends, that it wasn't a disgrace, that it would be okay to ask for help. You know, think of the lives we could save. You know, I've often said, I have a talk that I give. One of the things I do, I'm a internationally certified hostage negotiator. And so I have a talk that I do where I take a lot of the principles of hostage negotiation and look at addiction as one of the biggest terrorists that we face. And I talk about how in our schools, we have fire drills and tornado drills and, God forbid, active shooter drills. Mm-hmm. And yet, we also need to have addiction drills because addiction is far more likely to kill our children than a tornado or a fire. And so if we can really come together and begin to educate more, you know, how it's a disease, why it's a disease, what it looks like, and begin to tackle the chemical culture that we live in. You know, so for example, we do have this sort of, you know, if I have a headache, take a pill. Don't just take a tip, take an extra strength. If you're having a good time, you'll have a better time. If you have a beer in your hand, or, you know, then you'll be sexier and funnier. And, you know, there's even a morning show that will frequently have people drinking at 10 a.m. in the morning.
And I, are you serious?
Yes. I won't name it. But,
wow.
But in that, you know, I think if we tried to glamorize the late stage symptoms of any other illness, you know, people would be horrified. So when did morning, you know, morning drinking is not sexy. You know, morning drinking is someone who is trying not to go into withdrawal, you know, trying to get the, you know, shaking, trying to get the alcohol down, but usually, you know, having it come back up. I mean, it's awful. And so I think if we can begin to really educate about what it looks like and how do we come in and, you know, help respectfully support people who have this illness too. And it doesn't mean the world has to be teetotalers, because there are plenty of people that have a perfectly fine relationship with chemicals. But then there's that 1 out of 10 that don't. And how do you know what that looks like? And how are we respectful of that?
You know, I think that that is so applicable in not only regards to addiction, mental health as well. So like whether we break it apart and we're talking about eating disorders, primary mental health disorders, addiction, chemical or you know, sex, whatever, you know, I think it's easy to put our head, you know, do the ostrich, put our head in the sand and be like, that doesn't affect me, you know, and, but the fact of the matter is, if you're going to go outside and live in society, maybe you don't struggle with any of those things, but you know, you, whether you want to believe it or not, you are connected to people who do. And I think deep down, most people don't want to think of themselves as part of a problem. And so if we're not going to be part of the problem, what are we doing to figure out how to A, be part of the solution, and B, take an inventory of our language, of our, you know, all of those things with how, like, just like you said, a morning show that's doing what they're doing. Our conversation when we're talking about, I've started to address with myself, taking crazy out of my vocabulary because I've realized like that's, even if I'm joking, that is damaging.
Right. Vocab,
language.
For someone out here, it's extraordinarily painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. I love that you brought up, and I was going to ask you about the hostage thing, because there are so many parallels between those two, like the addiction side and what you were talking about. I was just wondering, if do you have a story about, I mean, I know that those things are confidential, but do you have a parallel, a specific parallel that you like to use as, in regard to that, like that, the mile markers and how they relate exactly to addiction?
You know, I think, let me see if this helps answer that. What happened for me, so I had, you know, a large private practice. I've seen about 50 clients a week. I did group therapy. And you know, I'm also, you know, I'm an equestrian, I ride show jumpers. So there's part of me that can't sit still for a long time without wanting to add something, do something different, get creative. So I was sort of thinking about, what am I going to do next? How do I add to my practice? This was before I started doing more interventions and shifting in that way. And I ran into one of the heads of the hostage negotiation and SWAT team here in my county. And we started up a conversation, and he said, you know, there's a new model where for our crisis negotiation teams, there's a psychological person on board, mental health professional. Would you be interested? And I'm like, sure. You know, I didn't really know what it meant, but I thought, I watched Law and Order. I mean, how hard could it be? Right. So,
yeah.
And thinking, like, I used to run from the police, and scared of the police. Now I'm going to work with the police.
Right.
That's kind of cool. So the next thing I knew, I was at FBI training. I, you know, because they have a training they do for sheriff departments. I was trained by some of NYPD's finest. As I sat in these trainings, I began to learn the principles, like how when you have a terror attack, it changes everything in your community. It changes how you think, how you go about your life. Like after 9/11, we never went through airports the same again. I learned about how, again, like the underlying principle of hostage negotiation is that there are zero acceptable losses. And with zero acceptable losses, that means, you know, we do everything we can. Lives are at stake. You know, and I started thinking, like, you know, when you have addiction in a family, it changes everything. It changes mm-hmm. how you see the world. It changes when you have an overdose in your community. It changes that family, changes the way it changes the climate at school, the culture, it changes our places of worship. And all of a sudden now there's this ripple effect, the pain, that existential crisis of why is this happening? How did this happen in my home, in my community? You know, we talk about zero acceptable losses. We have an illness that's treatable. And we need to come from that place where we're able to come in and say, wait a minute, for our illness too, there's zero acceptable losses. Like we're all on the front lines of battle. And what do we need to do to make that happen? And then I also started thinking about terrorists and taken hostage. And I started thinking about, well, you know, our midbrain's taken hostage. Mm-hmm. You know, our individuals are taken hostage by the drugs. We take our families hostage. So there's so many layers and so many parallels. And we are talking about lives. You know, same with hostage negotiation. You know, we're talking about lives being at stake, and the stakes are high. And the same with being on the front lines doing interventions or doing this work. You know, every day when we have an opportunity to introduce someone into the new world, the new life of recovery, and help them heal, you know, that's where, if we're not doing it ethically, if people are placed into the wrong treatment center, if families are taken advantage of, it's their one shot sometimes. Mm-hmm. And this is an illness that will kill you. And on the way there, it will wreck your family relationships. It'll affect your children. It'll affect your, you know, so a lot of damage can be done. And really coming in and trying to look at, you know, again, what are the underlying signs and symptoms? And you know, addiction is often, you know, Alice Miller talks about addiction as being a sign, a symptom, a signal of distress, and how important it is for us to come in and also not just work with the substance use disorder, but to come underneath and look at what are those signs and symptoms? Like, what is it telling us? What are we saying? You know, why is it that the United States uses 2/3 of the world's illegal substances? Like, what is that about for us? You know, how do we learn to live life on life's terms and not have those chemical answers? So I don't know all the answers to those things, but those are certainly questions and things that I find myself thinking about and found myself thinking about while, you know, taking, you know, hostage negotiation trainings and looking at how sometimes it's more difficult working with families struggling with addiction than it is, you know, a hostage situation.
Yes. Okay. So you touched on two things that I'm so glad you did, because I was going to go there anyway. But first, I wanted to mention one of those things was the disease, right? So I can't tell you, and I'm sure you see this as well, but from my angle and what I do professionally, I constantly run into people, families, whatever, who are unwilling or unable to look at this process from a disease perspective or approach. And, you know, you either get, I think the healthy way to look at it is through the disease lens. Some people say, oh, disease is just a scapegoat. But, you know, when, as you were talking through that, I thought back to my own personal story. And, when my mom, sometimes she'll tell my story for me, and she always talks about Patrick was a, like, just a model student. I was homeschooled my whole life. I volunteered for fun. I did all the right things, right?
Right.
I told the truth. I was not a liar. Like, I told the truth to a fault. Right. But when I started drinking and using, that all changed. Yes. And I remember, from what I can remember, like when I wasn't blacked out, the lies would come out of my mouth without... It was like, I wasn't creative enough to come up with the lies that were being woven out of my, I mean, like, there was something else in the driver's seat. It doesn't mean that I don't take responsibility for my actions and what I said, but that, for me, that's kind of that, what you were saying about that rings so true, in that, you know, the disease takes us hostage, and it doesn't just take us hostage. It takes the entire family hostage and the community and society around us.
Right.
Anybody who's been a part of it can throw their hand up and attest to be like, yeah, I'm either on that merry-go-round right now, or I just got off it, or, you know, whatever.
Right. Yes. And you know what you said is such an important piece too, which is that, you know, again, some people will say, okay, you guys are just using the disease as a cop-out, like to not take responsibility. And it's not about, if I have diabetes, I have to be responsible to check my blood sugar and make sure my insulin levels are okay. And
that's right.
Otherwise, I'm going to drive a car and be impaired and hurt someone. You know, I have to be responsible for this. So there's an accountability piece to it. But if you haven't, when the difference between someone who has this illness and who doesn't, I believe, this is my experience, so I can't speak for the world, but I can tell you the first time I used, it was life-changing. And most people who don't have this illness do not have that experience. The first time I used, I went from awkward, uncomfortable in my own skin, to suddenly able to talk to the cute boys at the party, thinking I was really funny, probably wasn't, but it really gave me this boost. And so when I hear them talk about the dopamine hypothesis of addiction and how that surge of dopamine, finally, you go from sort of anhedonia to being like, wow, wait a minute, the world's kind of okay. What do I have to do to feel like this? You know, I understand that. I also think that this is a very multifaceted illness. Like, I don't think there's one fix. So it's not, okay, now we're going to have a pill and that makes you in recovery and you won't use again. You know, I think that there are things you can do to help with cravings. But there's also the, you know, you have to build up those non-chemical coping skills, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And so it's not that, you know, I think when I first came in to the field, there was a little bit of a split between, you know, sort of the family therapists were over here, the addiction folks were over here, the mental health people were over here, the trauma people were, you know, there wasn't as, and this is 40 years ago, so they weren't really quite as cohesed as we are today. And part of the reason why, the family therapist had great, great information about dynamics of families and family systems and how important they are. But I think there was also, from the addiction side, we felt nervous and that maybe their understanding was, well, you come in and fix the family dynamics and then the drinking will decrease. And we knew differently. We knew you could do a lot of psychotherapy and still keep drinking. It wouldn't cure or stop a person who's alcoholic from drinking. Like, in fact, we had lots of documentation of that. On the other hand, we needed to be able to understand, in addition to doing what we needed to do to help someone recover, we also needed to bring in that family work for longer term, more sustainable recovery. So things have blended together now a lot better, but you know, again, there really is a multifaceted approach that works best when helping someone. You know, it really has to be family recovery as much as it possibly can be. You know, an individual recovers, and then it's an opportunity, in the best case ever, for other members of the family to begin their own recovery. And I think that is part of what helps that trajectory or that family narratives change from, oh, we come from a certain culture and we're full of alcoholics and we all, you know, die of alcoholism, to we experienced a lot of trauma when we immigrated to the United States, but we've also learned new and different ways to cope with that and deal with it. And now we have a lot of members in our family who are in recovery, and look at, you know, others, our children, our unborn grandchildren are benefiting from that healing as well. So it's a way to really come in and look at lots of different facets to help a person, you know, recover and really give a family an opportunity. You know, families are super important. You know, families are resilient. They have been around for a long time. They're going to keep being around. And those of us who work in this field, we have the opportunity, we have actually the honor that we're asked to step in and help give a little guidance. And then families may take that and they may not. But if they do, and the guidance is good and it's ethical, and we're working hard, to, we're not just coming in saying, here it is, here's the cookie cutter, you have to fit in it. We're working to help the families. We're working with respect and helping to look at their, you know, autonomy and their individualized needs, and then the families have the ability to take those tools and continue generationally to pass that on. There's a difference in a family whose legacy is, you know, grandmother created an entire business. She was an incredible woman and then she died drunk, versus grandmother was an incredible woman who created a business and then she got into some trouble with alcohol and pain pills. And at 79 years old, went to treatment, got into recovery, and we had an amazing relationship with her at the end of her life. And we've all now learned that when you get into trouble, you go and get help. Look at Betty Ford. Look at everything Betty Ford did.
Such a great point. And I love that you went straight into that, because that was my other thing that I was going to ask you about, is the family perspective and how important it is. We know that, those of us who work in the industry, how important that, the increased odds of an individual being able to heal when the family acknowledges and takes accountability for what, everything that is on the shoulders, that is part of that community that makes up, the individual. We see it time and time again where a client, the tip of the iceberg is the addiction presenting itself. And underneath are, all of the person's, underlying issues, traumas, and everything else, but also the families. And they've been able to keep it hidden because they don't have an addiction. You know what I mean? And so we've got mom, dad, aunt, uncle, whoever that's closely involved, that's going, well, we got to get this taken care of because it's making us all feel uncomfortable. And, when somebody mentions Al-Anon, when somebody mentions all these things that remotely involve taking any type of ownership, that there might be something outside of the realm of everything being the addict's fault and responsibility, people start to freak out. And so from my view, I think one of the things that I value so much is the work that you all do as interventionists, knowing that it is, you take such a heavy load on a burden that a lot of people don't know. So much of the intervention is that education and work with the family beforehand. And so I just wanted to ask you from that perspective, what is your, and I know, like you were saying, everybody's different and you don't know everybody's, different trauma and all that kind of thing from each family. But what is your pitch, if you will, to family members? How do you present that to say, why this is important, to uncover and take a look at yourselves as not like, hey, I caused this addiction, but every family is screwed up. How do you present that?
So that's a great question. So first off, let me say for a minute about how I think interventions work. So I don't go in and have the magic words and talk a person into going to treatment. I mean, if I could do that, it would be easier on families. I would relieve them of a lot of difficulties. No one wants to have called the interventionist. People would rather go get root canals. I'm like, we're the last ones they want to call, because it's hard. It's painful to admit, like, we've tried, things aren't any better. So the way I believe an intervention works is that I may know a lot about mental health issues, addiction issues, the dynamics, the structure, the procedure to help get someone to agree to go to treatment, but I mean nothing to the person that we're intervening on. The ones who mean the most to that person are the family members and the friends and the loved ones. Even if they feel like they've run them off, at some point in some way, there's still that connection and there's still that importance. So we work together. We work in tandem to come together. And actually, there is a lot of prep, a lot of helping the family understand the dynamics, understand like what's helpful, what supports health, what contributes to demise. But we strongly work together to help get the person to agree to go, that becomes a better option than the way they're living their lives. So in an intervention, the families are often doing a lot of the heavy lifting. It's not that I'm mute, but if I'm saying to someone, your grandmother is so worried about you, she can barely sleep at night, that may be true. But if grandmother's looking at her grandson with tears in her eyes saying, I don't know how much longer I have in this world, and I love you with all my being, and I have got to know that you're okay. You've got to do this for me. You're breaking my heart. Like, that's the magic in an intervention. And so with that, we begin to help families understand, again, some education. This is how a family system works. this is how we're all kind of connected to each other. Like family systems come together in ways where they're connected. And we all need connection. We have to have connection. We're social animals. We have to live with connection. But our connection just gets all clunked up. So literally what has to happen with families is that we have to be able to connect in a way where we're supporting health. We have to be able to deconstruct the way we connect and relate to each other so that we can reconnect in a healthier way. And if you don't do that, and this is hard, it's hard to get out of this. These are my family members. It's hard to get out of this. And when you're here, there's nothing. Like, well, I don't know what this is. What's going to happen next? It's scary. But this is suffocating and killing and cramping my hand. So helping families understand that we've got to take a look at ourselves. It's an opportunity to really make some changes so that we can come back and connect in a way where it's going to be the most successful way for people to heal and recover. And some of that is really doing what in relational cultural therapy, which came out of the Stone Center in Massachusetts, they talk a lot about the importance of getting to a place where instead of being in that victim, persecutor, rescuer triangle where you're beating yourself up and or you're blaming everybody else in the world or I was a bad parent or this or that, to be able to what they call turn towards your woundedness. And if you can turn into that woundedness and begin to have some self-compassion and understanding for yourself, then you'll have it for others. You'll have more energy to really be able to come and connect and your life will change. And I believe that's, you know, a lot of what we do through our own healing, through the 12 steps, through, you know, it's an opportunity to really stop, pause, be accountable. You know, the opposite of what those folks that are saying, oh, you're just blaming on your disease, you know, begin to heal yourself so you can begin to then heal your relationships. And everyone benefits from that. So if you talk to families too about, again, it's not that you're loved one, Uncle Joe, who needs an intervention to go to rehab, he's not making everybody feel awful. I mean, he feels awful too. But what's happening is that generations, like let's do a family tree and look at it, generations of trauma, mental health issues, sudden grief and loss, substance use, this is what's affecting Uncle Joe. And those of you who may not use, you're still affected because you're so close to it. Mm-hmm. So you may not use substances, but when you watch a family member self-destruct slowly over time, it's traumatic. It's painful. You know, it's sometimes more painful than being in the other role. You know, so part of what we need to do is really help depathologize the way we speak to our families. You know, not come in and say, you're sick or you're enabling or you know, you have to do this, or but to come in and say, this is an exciting part about recovery, is that there's a way that you can begin to heal and all of your relationships will change. And if you don't have, look at this family tree, if you don't have substance use and mental health issues and, you know, all these other things, like you don't have to have that in your life. And if you get rid of that, look at how much more energy you have to do other things, to reevaluate your family values, the way you connect, your family rituals, to have a life better than the life you had before you came into this space. And some people get excited about that. Others, for whatever reason, can't do the work, you know, or, you know, there's too much pain, there's too much, again, but it's an opportunity for everyone to really grow and change and heal.
Sure. This such great advice and insight. You know, we have spent a good portion of our talk talking about the addiction side of things. And I wanted to also pick your brain on the mental health side, because we are at such a place where I think that, just like you mentioned earlier, like there is a platform for it. People are paying attention. People are somewhat on board with breaking stigma, or at least having the conversation. And you know, I think for the most part, everybody could raise their hand and say either I or somebody I know, you know, takes a antidepressant or this or that. But we are seeing a lot of people, especially coming out from the pandemic isolation. We've seen acuities spike in mental health disorders and people needing, you know, higher levels of help as it comes to that. I just wonder what your perspective is on the approach for, you know, lay people, the regular person, when we're talking about supporting our fellows that and changing our language, all of those things. You know, what are you seeing? What would you recommend in this whole realm of things?
So, which is great, because it's sort of what we started talking about earlier on when I had all those thought, you know, those ideas and things I wanted to mention. You know, we are coming out of the pandemic. Substance use is higher, but also mental health. More people are experiencing anxiety, difficulty sleeping. There's been an increase in domestic violence, an increase in child abuse. Female teen suicide has increased by 50%. I mean, the numbers are startling. I've also seen in my personal practice, we've had a lot of individuals throughout the pandemic and continuing now, where we're looking at a lot of psychosis from either abuse of, it can either be substance abuse induced psychosis, like from Adderall or methamphetamine or marijuana, and then others that are having, first psychotic breaks, second psychotic breaks with no history of substance use disorder. So again, with that, those of us who are on the front lines, who are coming out of the pandemic, the mental health workers who are out there, it's not like we just had a 2-year break. We're also exhausted. So again, you know, everything, you know, mental health issues are more intense and extreme. The numbers are a lot higher and we're all on the front lines. And, you know, so it's important if you're a mental health worker to remember your self-care. And if you're a lay person, again, ask for help, reach out, be wary of the internet, because once you start Googling and you can end up in that wormhole where it gets more confusing, like there are good professionals out there that can help. We do have a deficit of brick and mortar facilities to help with mental health. We do have counselors are overrun. Last I saw, you know, the average appointment to get in with a psychiatrist was like 3 to 4 months out. So we are having a crisis. We do, as a community, as a country, need to look at what can we do to help improve the services that we have to offer. I live in Georgia. I think we were like last. I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed about it, but we were like, they just ranked mental health, how states treat mental health. And I think Georgia was like 50. So again, we need to look at what can we do to also help, not just let this be, you know, that only those who are affluent are able to afford treatment, but how do we help on a grassroots level? How do we help within our communities? How do we start to notice things? And again, prevention too, like, 1 in 5 American at some point in their life will experience a diagnosable mental health disorder. And then in any given, or I think, or maybe that's in a given year, I may have my stats wrong here, but my point is that it is across the board. It is more common than you would think. And then with a lot of them, it starts with kids who are 14. We know when adolescents start to show signs and symptoms, if you can get in there and begin to get them some help, some new coping skills, some family work, you will help decrease their need for treatment later on. If you don't come in and help them earlier on, they're more likely to exhibit, again, full-blown substance use disorder and other mental health issues. So talk about it. Ask for help. You know, I am blessed to live in a beautiful community where we have quarterly drug and alcohol addiction summits that are educational for the community. And we also have mental health summits where people are also learning about different mental health issues and suicide and other, you know, ways to help cope and resources. So talk about it, reach out. there are good licensed professionals. Again, the mental health world is a world where you really need to have some good training. You need to be a licensed professional. You need to have gone to graduate school and studied, you know, because it's very complex. You know, my belief, you know, intervention, substance use intervention and mental health intervention, it's not an entry level position if it's done well. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's very dangerous when people have only been sober a few months or a couple of years, don't have any training, take a workshop, and then are suddenly out, you know, marketing themselves as working with families with addiction and particularly with mental health issues. The more harm
so true.
Can be done. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got two follow-up questions to that. So for the person who is watching or listening that has someone in their life that they suspect is struggling with you know, a mental health disorder that's interfering with their life, the two things that I get, you know, things that come up quite frequently are either my friend or family member is struggling severely with this mental health issue, or I think it's mental health because I don't really know.
Right.
You know, what role do I play? And I don't think they're getting any help. What role do I play and how do I approach that to nudge them in the right direction? So that's the first question. My second question is, how do you recommend people support someone in their life that they do know is struggling and they receive help, but it's difficult? You know, how do you recommend supporting somebody who regularly struggles?
So I think
with severe mental health issues,
that the answer to both of those are really kind of the same. Talk to them, be honest, be transparent. Like that helps build trust, not in a shaming way. I'm worried about you. I haven't seen you in a while. You seem to be isolating more. Is something going on? You know, how can I help you? How can we help you? And then also learn about, there are places where you can learn about how to help someone. So for example, NAMI is a great organization that really, they have courses that you can take. They're doing them virtually as well as, I don't know if they're doing the in-person as much, but they do courses that help you understand. Again, there's power in knowledge. So if you understand how someone, you know, what their diagnosis might be or what they're struggling with, then you know how to approach them differently. You know, part of what happens, you know, mental health issues are brain disorders. So often we want things to make logical sense, but they don't make logical sense because there's not that logic to it. So you could say, well, she stays in bed all day and I want to tell her you need to get up at 8 and you have breakfast at 9 and then you go and you do X, Y, and Z and then you do this and that. And most people, if they could do those things, they would.
Yeah.
You know, so it's to understand why coming in, you know, and also if you keep saying the same thing and having the same conversation, this works for clinicians too, then maybe you're not saying it right. I mean, it's often not, you know, there are other ways. And people with mental health issues often need professional help to get better. And that's more than just a psychiatrist seeing them for 15 minutes once a month. Like the idea that we can help treat someone's mental illness in 15 minutes once a month is really pretty absurd. So, I mean, I think there's some places that the mental health, that's probably a whole nother podcast.
It is. I was going to add to that with the amount of times that I hear, oh, my primary care physician prescribes my psych meds.
Right.
You know, my eyes, I think, do a full flip.
Right. My pediatrician takes care of my child's ADHD medicine,
yeah.
You know, and how often, first off, we know the stats of how many we have in the country and then how much is prescribed. You're way out of sync. So, you know, again, but that, yes, that's another show. I'd love to do another podcast sometime too and talk more about adolescents and how they get to treatment and what treatment looks like too, because there's so much publicity right now and legislation going on because of the struggling teen community and things that I think have been done that were done that haven't been done right, that have been re-traumatizing to kids, but then to also highlight the things out there that are being done right too. I mean, again, it's another area where I think a lot of the problems are being looked at and the solutions aren't.
Such a great point. And just, I would love to have you on for a part two to talk about that anytime. So we'll have to go there. But I think that you hit the nail on the head that is such a, a needed topic to approach. Mm-hmm. From the treatment world, I can tell you that it's so common that those of us who are in the profession tend to, and myself included, because I don't work in the realm of adolescence. So I go, you know, when somebody, asks about it, talks about it or whatever, I'm like, oh, well that, you know, there's Cumberland Heights got a great program. I'm not well educated in the facts, the statistics, the anything, because we're still sectioned off. And so I think that, across the board, we could do so much more conversation, education, as it relates to the need for adolescent.
Yes.
Solution.
Yes.
Before we close, I wanted to ask you what, is there anything that you've got on the horizon that you wanted to talk about with Heather Hayes and Associates, anything you're doing professionally that you wanted to highlight?
That's a great question. So I'm working on a couple of different books. Hopefully, my intention was to really knock it out during the pandemic, but that did not happen. But I'm working on a couple of different books. I'm excited about that. I have, I've been putting out a blog a week. So part of my sort of trying to look at where I'm at in my career, I've been doing this for a long time, has been to try and make a commitment that each week I'm going to put out more information in the form of a blog, something easy to read. And you can probably get a sense too of what kind of cases I'm working with, because all of a sudden you may see two blogs in a row on OCD or drug-induced psychosis or schizoaffective disorder. Or so part of it is I'm putting that information out, and then I'm also trying to create more information to help get the families that I work with as well. So that's exciting. And I feel really good about, the work that I'm doing with my, I feel like we really come in. I'm so proud of my team. I feel like I'm only as good as my team behind me. And so I really appreciate the fact that they all work so hard with me. I have some excellent clinicians on the team. We, come in and work with the families. We won't do an intervention unless a family will let us continue to work with them for 6 months so that we're really able to begin to help them shift and support their loved one through treatment. So all of that is really exciting to me. And then, personally, and I think that's all a part of self-care too. I think it's really important for everyone. I've have a beautiful life. I ride my horses. I just got a new show jumper that I can't wait to get into the show ring. My husband is amazing and supports me, and I support him, and we, have a lot of fun together and enjoy our stepchildren. And it's a beautiful time of year. This is my favorite time of year. I love to garden. I love to cook. So I'm just waiting for two more weeks where I can get the vegetables in the ground and all of that. So, part of people say to me, how do you do it? You've been doing it so long. And I think the reason I'm able to do it is because, I always, first off, I always remember, no matter what, every day, that my own personal recovery has to come first in my self-care. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, that's it. But then also, to have other things than just work that I love and that I'm passionate about. And that's important. My horses are a big piece of my mental health and all of my animals and my farm. So, and my amazing family. So that's sort of what I would leave you with. I'm just excited about, during the pandemic, it was a very difficult time. Way things worked changed, but my husband and I had like the sweetest, he's an attorney and he has a home office. So we were here together a lot and discovered like 10 miles of walking trails right around the corner and started taking the dogs for walks together. We never would have found it. When you have 11 acres, you don't really go take the dogs for a long walk, but we one day said, let's do it. I'm surprised I even said the word and they didn't come running in. So anyway, lots of exciting lots of exciting things professionally and personally. So, and just grateful.
I love that.
Grateful and blessed. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I just wanted to comment. My favorite time of year as well is the spring. And I think because there are, I mean, you could draw a parallel between any season and recovery.
Yes.
But especially the spring, because our alumni program is called Rooted. And we call it that because of that parallel of a plant in our recovery and growing our roots. And I just love metaphors. I've always been one of those people where if you want to feed me new information, I'm going to get it the best way. Give me a metaphor. And so I think that spring is such a great metaphor for, doing what we're supposed to do, using our tools and watching those roots grow and seeing things bloom.
You know, that's so beautiful. And when you said that, it reminded me, because, you know, my recovery date is February 24th. So it took a few months for things to start. But I distinctly remember one of the first times it was spring, and I remember looking and going, look at all the colors. I never knew there were so many greens in a tree. And I mean, it was like the world, like all of a sudden the fog lifted. And there was this, and I think that's also part of my appreciation for the spring too. It was just like I saw the world like I'd never seen it before. So.
That's beautiful. All right, last question before we close out. What is the final word of encouragement you'd like to leave for that person that has listened to your story, heard you talking today, that's, they're struggling and they're saying, yeah, I think I need help. What would you like to leave with them?
What I would say is don't ever give up. That there are, if you've struggled and you've tried and things aren't working, reach out for help. There are those of us out there who can really help work together with you, not for you, but with you to figure out what have been the missing pieces. How can we help you? You know, there are people out there that if you've gotten into recovery and it's been so painful, or you've not been able to, you know, to stay in recovery, to stay abstinent from drugs and alcohol or whatever the behavior is, you know, that don't give up. Don't give up. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It might mean that we just need to, you need a better plan, you know, and there are people out there that can help. So, and that you will have the opportunity, if you can just hang in there through the hard times, and it'll be hard, you can have a life better than you ever imagined.
I love that so much. Okay. So I think this is so cool. I have, you know, those little rubber statement bracelets you can have. I have one on my wrist and you probably can't read it, but it literally says, never, never give up. And somebody asked me the other day, they said, what is that in reference to? And for me, I mean, you know, clearly if there's a foundation of recovery there, but it's everything. It's, you know, if I'm having a bad day, all the things that I know that I need to do to maintain joy and health in life, all of those things. I love that that is the root of what you just said. Never give up, because so many of the people that we tend to help along the way come to us and say, I've done treatment 8 times, didn't work. I've done AA, I've done this, I've done that. And there is always something different, a new path to try.
That's right.
And so I could not echo that enough. Heather, thank you so much. And I wanted to just also say, we're going to have all the links and ways that you can connect with Heather's resources, her company, and services in the show notes below for those of you who would like to connect with her. And lastly, I will close out by saying, you are always only one decision away from a completely different life, and it is never too late to start loving yourself.
For more information on today's episode, check out the show notes. Recovery Stories is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted Alumni Community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098. or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help. Whether you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please share with your friends. Follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. We are grateful for you and hope that you have been encouraged by today's episode. As always, remember you are only one decision away from a completely different life, and it is never too late to start loving yourself.